Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Strength Academy Podcast. Once again, this is Mundo, and I'm joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
And we have a special guest for y'all today, and she's going to introduce herself, tell us a little bit about what she does and how this topic that we're going to talk about kind of came into play, and then a little bit about her weightlifting adventure as well. So if you wouldn't mind, Alisa.
Oh, good job on my name. Hi, everyone. My name is Alisa Domholt, but I go by Allie because everyone, including my coaches, has a hard time pronouncing my name. So I'm just going to call y'all out on the spot. So I have been with Grayson and company for, about 3 years now, maybe more like 4 years, actually, because I started in 2015. And before that, I was doing CrossFit. So I started out without having any background knowledge in functional fitness, joined a CrossFit gym, and realized that weightlifting was really where it was at for me. And so in the meantime, I also was going through graduate school. I've got a bachelor's in psychology and was doing a master's in social work. And after I graduated, I went to work for UNMH, which I work for now, and I work in substance use. So I'm a therapist, kind of helping people figure out how to stop using substances, how to live better lives, and what kind of motivates them to make those changes. And so a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to the podcast, and Mundo and Grayson were talking a lot about what motivates people, because especially for making change in weightlifting or making better change in things like sleep or food, you know, or how do I change my diet? I mean, that makes a big, that's a big part of kind of what we do. And so I was really glad they started that conversation. And then I just wanted to bring to the table a couple of things today about continuing that conversation about motivating.
Okay.
Sweet. Yeah. So the main topic of today is going to be motivational interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kind of put forth my assertion of what I think it is, and we'll see if that lines up
with the actuality.
So it's essentially a way of guiding people to make those decisions on their own. So not laying down, you need to change this about your diet or X is going to happen to you. Not using fear to motivate. Not making people feel like you're nagging them or forcing them into a situation, but how do we get people to...
Right.
Yeah, so eliminating the ultimatum and letting people kind of make that decision themselves, kind of guiding them in that direction. Is that somewhat accurate?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. So just a quick background on motivational interviewing, MI for short. Motivational interviewing is a really stupid sounding concept, but it's a great thing in practice. So I wish they had just named it something else, but UNM is actually kind of considered the home of motivational interviewing. It was developed right here at University of New Mexico. And so some of the original researchers and a lot of the clinical trials were conducted here, which was awesome. So that's kind of a cool claim to fame for New Mexico. And it was developed back in the 80s to actually help people stop using substances because, you know, as we all remember, kind of in the 80s, it was just say no.
And yeah, yeah.
Guess what? Just saying no to cocaine doesn't really work.
Because a lot of people use cocaine.
A lot of people smoke.
Yeah.
You know, and a major issue, I think, in the medical field was that a lot of people eat too high sugar. You know, we have this type 2 diabetes kind of epidemic. And telling people to just stop it, and if you want it enough, you'll make that change, isn't really motivating.
Right.
So they figured out, okay, so how do we have a collaborative conversation where the other person who is going to do the change does most of the talking? So it's not me as a doctor or a therapist or a person of authority saying, here's all the reasons that you should change. And actually, that's when motivational interviewing should not be used. I should not be telling you as a doctor or a coach or a therapist all of the evidence as to why you should change, because you already know that probably smoking is bad for you.
Well, right? That's kind of the why the smoking labels don't actually work.
Right.
Because you can put smoking pills on the package, but people, it's smoking kills people that aren't me.
Well, yes, there's a piece of that.
Well, it's kind of like the toddler-centric view of the world, where it's just like, I'm going to do this because it makes me feel good, and unless I'm the one that changes that behavior, like, nobody else is really going to try to make me do the things that, you know, I need to do.
Well, and that's tough. I mean, I feel like there's a piece of both of those things, but I really think so much is that before motivational interviewing, we weren't recognizing how many barriers there are to change.
Right.
So there is this kind of, you know, if you want Like for me, for instance, I want to stop eating sugar. And kind of the rhetoric that I got from doctors and even from like friends and family members was, okay, you should just stop because you're going to get fat and you're going to have poor lifting results and you're going to get diabetes. And if you want it bad enough, Allie, just stop it. Right. And so when I couldn't make that change, I actually felt worse about myself, because if the answer was just stop it and I couldn't, that meant morally I have some type of deficiency,
right,
or like I'm unintelligent, or, you know, I'm not capable enough.
Right. So this is where, the idea of like motivational interviewing comes into play, because a lot of times we do have behaviors, and I'm sure each and every one of us have behaviors that we'd like to change or get rid of, mm-hmm. or something that we'd like to adopt and make ourselves a little bit better. But sometimes we just don't know how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is a good topic to kind of breach into the subject of trying to get there.
Yes.
And how we can go about doing that. So this was developed at UNM. Mm-hmm. What kind of people did they test this out on to begin with?
So specifically people who were trying to discontinue substances. So they looked at heroin users, cocaine users, some of the real popular drugs that were in the 80s. And again, the model before that was the just stop it model. This is bad for you,
right,
versus let's recognize what the barrier is. Whether it's might be education, but more likely it's how you feel about yourself, or trouble accessing treatment, or what are your values? So a lot of what revolves around this conversation is, what do you value in life, and how can we tap into what you value so that you make that change?
Right.
So bringing people out of a kind of nihilistic worldview and kind of giving them some, like trying to help them identify purpose
definitely.
In themselves.
It's the opposite of blaming.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like, I think that when people try something, and they legitimately try, like, let's say they start a new diet, and they go on this diet for whatever is supposed to be 30 days, they end up making it maybe like 2 weeks into it, and then they just kind of like fall
mm-hmm.
off the bandwagon.
But
then the whole 30 is one of those. But like, people feel worse
yes,
afterwards.
They
feel like, oh man, I'm such a failure.
Exactly.
I can't even stick to eating like certain types of foods. Like, what else can I not do right?
Exactly.
So like, that's maybe not the best way to go about approaching it. So like, what kind of steps would people take to get to the point where it's like, okay, I know I need to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And they've reached that point. So there's a cycle that goes on in this, right?
There is.
We talked a little bit about like pre-contemplation. So pre-contemplation is the point where people haven't thought about changing. They don't have any desire to change. And so those people you can't really help, because it's like that toddler mentality. It's like, you're not gonna help the toddler become a better person just by not giving him a sucker one time. It's got to be something that, you know, they develop on their own, like an awareness that, oh, I can't have this thing all the time. Like, I can't eat Lucky Charms for breakfast every day,
right,
because it's going to make me like terrible, like feel terrible. So
right,
they have to get to a point to where they feel like, okay, I do need to make a change.
Right. I need to make a change. Like, if I'm a constant smoker,
right,
and I haven't made the connection that me constantly smoking is probably bad for my workouts. If I've just said, I don't really have a problem, it's the I don't have a problem
right
kind of mentality, right, then you can't use motivational interviewing. And before we go through the other stages of change, I just wanted to say, the other time as coaches and as teachers, the only other time that we don't want to use motivational interviewing is if you and that person fundamentally disagree.
Okay.
So if you and that person both agree that you want that person to lift more, but they say, no, I want to do it this way, and you think they should do it that way, that's not collaborative.
Oh, okay.
Right? We have to kind of agree, okay, this is the direction that we're heading. The other time you don't want to do it is if you have a vested interest in the outcome. So like, if I have an athlete that if they go to this meet, maybe they'll win a bunch of money, and then I will get a bunch of notoriety, and that's the reason I'm doing it,
sure,
that also isn't collaborative.
Okay.
So I don't want to use like coercive power,
right.
Because again, the spirit of MI is meeting somebody in that space of equality and figuring out what motivates you.
Okay, and we talked a little bit about this as coaches as well. So like, I think a coach's job is to try to bring out the best in his athletes,
yes,
like to try to get them to perform to their best. And what I think that they're capable of and what they think they're capable of don't always match up.
Right.
But how do we get people to see that they do have the potential to reach some of the goals that they're trying to achieve?
Right.
So like, let's talk about that for a little
okay
bit.
Or even aiming higher.
Or aiming higher, yeah.
Right,
so,
right.
So let's talk about like contemplation
okay
and where that puts people at. And
so the very first thing which we've referenced was pre-contemplation. I don't have a problem, so I don't need to change. Then you shift to contemplation. I'm aware a problem exists. I'm aware that smoking is probably not good for my lifting, but I don't know how to fix it, and I'm not super motivated to fix it. But you can start to have those conversations with somebody in that space. But you can't jump to solutions. The idea of MI is that you, as a coach, do not give them solutions. They have to come up with themselves. So then people may move to the stage that's called preparation, which is, I know I have a problem. I also am now actually getting ready to take action. So I haven't done it yet, but maybe I've like called 1-800-QUIT. I've talked to people about how I want to stop smoking. I'm now like engaging in some of that talk that indicates change. And then finally we have action, which is, okay, I've thought about it. I know it's a problem. I've made preparations. Now let's do it, and I need your help.
Okay.
And so we have to figure out, when having a conversation with somebody, where on the wheel they are. Are they pre-contemplative, which means they're not going to engage in that conversation, and that's okay, we have to wait? Or are they somewhere between thinking about it, preparing, and taking action? Okay. Because our approach has to be different depending on where they are.
So in the contemplation phase, as you know, so if this is, you know, coaches helping athletes,
mm-hmm.
Is that sort of where you maybe indirectly address the problem, but you don't say we have to entirely overhaul this? So if you're in the contemplation phase about taking, say, your mobility more seriously or the quitting
mm-hmm.
smoking,
yes.
Is that where maybe the commentary from you as the coach or the therapist is more of, have you considered that maybe you'd feel better if you tried this? But is that like, is that jumping the gun, or
yes.
is that so that's a jumping
so
the gun?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because so many of us as helpers want to do that, and it's called the writing reflex.
Okay.
The writing reflex is when we try and offer education when a person is still kind of ambivalent. So if somebody is ambivalent or uncertain about making this change, they're in that contemplation space, if we offer them education, facts, and resources, research shows that actually they'll dig in their heels more. And what they do
okay.
is the opposite. So if I say, man, I really want to quit, I really want to stop eating sugar, and Mundo comes to me, and you'd never do this, but if you came to me and were like, did you know that if you keep eating sugar, your teeth are going to rot, you're going to get fatter, and you probably can't compete, I would basically say, I need you to step off.
Yeah, yeah.
And recognize. So.
Well, I think part of that comes from, so you're not entirely sure that you want to change. You understand that maybe a change needs to take place,
yes.
or that you might change something and it'll end up getting you in a better place. The problem is that you're not entirely ready to do the work that's required to get there. So that somebody else telling you all these solutions
right.
is just overwhelming. It's like getting all this information about stuff you don't know what to do with yet. And so like you start off not knowing what you don't know, and then all of a sudden everybody's just pouring information on you, like, oh, you should stop doing this, you should stop doing this,
right.
and you tried this, and you tried this, was like, oh, that's too much. Like, never mind,
yes.
just forget about the whole process.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so the key, if somebody, and really in all these stages, but especially in contemplation, is asking questions. So the questions we should be asking as the helper in this situation are always going to be open-ended questions, right? So they shouldn't be a yes or no, and they should be finding out what that person values and what motivation they have.
Okay.
So like, what was the example you used, Grayson? I want mobility
maybe,
or something?
Yeah, it's like improving mobility. You know, because we've all seen lifters where, you know, you've got tons of strength to display, but the positions could just be
right.
that if you just devoted a little more time to making sure that you were mobile enough to receive in a slightly better position, we're confident that, you know, your lifts would go up. But how do we get that person to buy in or
Absolutely.
Start, or start, you know, like, so is it like asking like a leading question, like, why do you feel like the snatch receiving position is off today? Is that a better example?
Maybe,
I mean,
maybe approaching it like that. It seems like you're having some difficulty with that position. Like, is there anything that you think that might improve that you haven't tried yet? Or that maybe leading them in the direction of maybe mobility might be the answer for you to try to improve, but not telling them mobility is the answer. So it's more like saying, you know, if you're thirsty, there's water over here if you want it. But you don't necessarily have to have a drink. I'm just offering it to you.
The hard part, again, though, is part of that's going to, that's still almost jumping a little bit too far ahead. Okay. And it's tough because we really want that. We the most that we want is for our athletes to be the most mobile they can and the most motivated. Right. But even then, it's still jumping the gun just a little bit by saying, here's a solution over here.
Okay, I see.
So a lot of it would be if, say, you came to me and you were like, man, I'm having a really tough time getting it. Like, you came to me as an athlete and said, I'm having a tough time with this. I think I might need to stretch more. Or, like, is there a stretch for this?
Oh, okay.
And starting to engage them in that conversation when they've elicited it versus me going up to them and saying, wow, essentially what you're doing is wrong.
Right.
Here's a better way you can do this. Because again, even no matter how we phrase it, people will read through the lines and the empathy goes down.
And they kind of put their guard up a little
bit. Absolutely. And that's that writing reflex is I want to be like, okay, yeah, I know what I should be doing.
So
stop talking to me.
It's a little bit more like athletes looking at another athlete and saying, maybe being a little envious of their position and see how easy it is. Like, oh, okay, so they start to value their mobility. Like, so the mobility in their mind becomes more of you become aware that you're lacking mobility. So then you start to value it. You start to value it in other people. So then you start to seek out information. Like, oh, maybe I need to improve my mobility. If I want my lifts to look like that person's lifts, like, it's not coming from an outside source. It's intrinsic.
Right. So
like, they're starting to develop the idea and the mentality that, oh, maybe I need to change something. So then they start to seek out information. They ask the coach, hey, my bottom position doesn't look like so-and-so's. Like, what is he doing differently? Or what can I do differently to try to get to that point?
That's a great example. And if somebody comes up and says that, and you in that case, they do want a straight educational answer.
Right.
So you provide them, oh, well, here are the three stretches. And if they're able to do those for the next week, great. You don't need motivational interviewing. Right. But if then they come to you and say, man, I've just been trying to do this for like the last 3 months and I can't make it work. I don't know why. That is the piece of where you go, okay. So you're not asking me for straight education, but what you're trying to figure out is, why can't I do this? I've set aside the time. I've told myself it's really important, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing wrong. So then the question becomes, so why is it important for you to get more mobility?
Right. Yeah, because then you get to the bottom of why they value that thing to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so you use that value to kind of extract the effort from them to accomplish that, whatever they need to do.
So is that kind of putting that in perspective? So saying, you know, it kind of highlights where the disconnect between their behavior and the outcome that they value is that kind of what you're doing within that?
Yes, you're starting to do, but really it is getting them to identify out loud why it's important for them to change. So Grayson, if you're an athlete that comes, you know, to me and says, Allie, I just don't know why I can't figure this out. I'm just going to ask you, I'm just going to throw you on the spot for a little bit of role play and say, well, why is getting better mobility important to you, Grayson?
Because I want to lift heavier weights.
You want to lift heavier weights. And it sounds like right now, your inability to get in the bottom positioning is preventing you from doing that. Does that feel right?
That is true.
Awesome. So I did two things there. I asked an open-ended question of why, and then I reflected back to him what I heard. Because another big thing about motivational interviewing is letting the listener know that you are empathic, you understand. Because if I had said to you, oh, so you just want to lift bigger weights to look cooler, that's not right.
Well, you just added that. Like, that was part of the conversation. Yeah, you just threw that in there.
I threw that in there.
Yeah.
And that's me leading or just making an arbitrary statement.
Sure.
So no matter what Grayson gives me, I'm going to reflect some of that back to him. And it sounds silly, and it can be really, really simple. And in like advanced MI trainings, you've got all kinds of more options for reflections. But just the act of hearing, wow, I hear what you said. Tell me more about that.
Okay.
You know, so then I would say, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's just, I think sometimes that repeating back to people, they don't understand, sometimes it's really hard for you as a person to understand what you sound like when you're talking. So if somebody repeats your point that you just made back to you, it can sound completely different than when it came out of your mouth.
Very true.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Very true. And then that also elicits more space for giving a more conversation to that too. Because if you were like, no, that's not it, you know, then I'd say, well, why, what specifically is it about, you know, the bottom position, or what specifically is it about lifting heavy that's motivating you?
Yeah, that's...
What is motivating you to try to lift heavy, Grayson?
I mean, I just want to end my weightlifting career knowing that I did as much as I could have.
Yeah, and okay. That's, so it's that no regrets, like,
yeah.
Looking back at your lifting career and just being like, you know what, I did everything I could to be the best possible athlete that I could be, and this is, was part of that process.
And that's definitely it for me.
Yep, yeah. So Mundo just gave a great reflection, which shows that he understood what Grayson was saying, and then Grayson felt validated by that, and he was like, yeah. So now you guys, even if you've barely met each other, which y'all have, but you guys were just able to build rapport in that moment. And you have to have rapport in order to elicit change talk from somebody. They got to feel like you're listening. They got to feel like you're empathic and like, oh yeah, this guy kind of gets me. Or else down the road, when they go into preparation or action, when they do want some advice on how to actually elicit change,
right.
They want to listen to you.
Yeah, because they already have a connection with
you.
Like
right.
You're already like an inside source of information for them. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I think that as coaches, it's important to try to develop these types of feedback loops, these
mm-hmm.
positive feedback loops, because when you're trying to get the most out of people and you're trying to help them achieve the things that they want to achieve, it's like it's important to listen to what they want, because obviously they're the athlete, they know where they're at, and when we provide feedback, it's to improve them, and usually that process has to include them as well, so you have to be getting feedback from the athlete.
Yes, you do.
So,
and then it is that collaborative spirit,
right?
In addition to asking somebody about like those open-ended questions and those reflections, if they move to the preparation stage, so remember the preparation stage is I've thought about it, I know why, and I'm now starting to look at steps, concrete steps that I can take to change, I could then go to Grayson and say, okay, so what are some of the strengths that you have as a person or an athlete that are going to help you make this change?
Oh, man.
Right?
That's kind of tough. That's kind of a tough one.
Is it putting you on the spot a little too much?
No, that's actually really good. I think that, you know, as a strength, you know, I do kind of have a bit of a single-minded focus. I'm very detail-oriented and intent on... I center everything around weightlifting.
Outstanding.
So I already have that as kind of a piece there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important. I tapped out.
No worries. No worries. That's a really good start, though. So you're dedicated and you're focused, right? Are there some other personal strengths, maybe about... you know, being able to schedule your day around weightlifting, or anything else about your personality that you feel would be an asset to you in making this change?
I think that it's a double-edged sword, but the amount of how obsessive I am about what positions I'm in, or like within training, like the level of detail that I'm trying to get to is good and bad. But I can, you know, I'm very focused on the minute details, but that sometimes allows me to get too caught up in those details.
Right. We've talked about hyper-focus sometimes and how that can actually be a barrier for you. But, you know, the fact is when you warm up, you're really intentional. Right, about hitting those positions. It's something that you've told me before and you've encouraged in your athlete as a part of gaining mobility is I'm gonna really hit that bottom position, I'm gonna hold it. And then I'm gonna be really intentional about the next position, I'm gonna hold it. I'm gonna do a really thorough bar warm up. And those are real strengths and assets that you have.
Yeah, definitely. I think if I could apply the same focus I had to my reps in the snatch to replicating the boring part of the warm-up,
right,
that's where I need to step it up. Is if I'm feeling rushed or distracted, my roll activation of pre-barbell stuff takes a hit when I'm distracted.
So that's really good, because now we have another piece of information, which is a barrier. Right, so feeling rushed and distracted can sometimes be a barrier to making some of those changes that we talked about.
intense.
Yes. I wish you guys could see Grayson's face right now because he's so uncomfortable with me putting him on the spot. Yeah, you're doing an incredible job. Yeah. Like, you're doing a super good job for me just throwing stuff out there. So now that we know a barrier and we know a bunch of strengths you have, what do you think are some concrete steps you can do, maybe in your next warm-up or just thinking about the next week, to eliminate the rushing so that we can get the good mobility?
I need to standardize what I'm doing.
Okay.
And that usually helps. Like, when you have a routine, you know that this is going to take this long, it's going to entail these things, and you know exactly how long it needs to be, how long it needs to take, and what it needs to look like for you to get into the proper mentality. So that's a good, place to start for sure. Standardizing your routine.
Yeah, and so maybe writing it down would be helpful.
Okay, writing it down.
I can just check it off as I go.
Because as coaches, if you guys were having this conversation with your athletes and they gave the answer of standardizing it and you were like, great, let's go do it, you actually cut off a whole bunch more information, right? I want you to tell me how you're going to do that.
Okay, so
I'm not going to supply you with the answer, right, but I'm going to say, so Grayson, what does that mean to you?
Yeah,
how did you standardize?
What does standardizing look to you?
Writing down the important breathwork drills, areas that I know that I need to activate based on prior PT things, and then prioritizing the most important stretches and drills that I know have worked well in the past, even if I don't like them and they're uncomfortable. Because I think that a lot of it is, this is actually really funny, but part of my biggest barrier to doing banded walks or banded clamshells or anything is I hate getting my leg hair pulled out.
And I know exactly how that feels.
I'm not going to lie.
I do.
Every time I'm like, I'll do some glute bridges, I'm like, I don't want to put that thing on my legs. Mm-hmm. So I need to wear tights more often.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's acknowledge that. Right. Let's put it out there for what it is.
Well, winter's coming too, so jogger season's coming up.
Yeah,
so
there we go. Right. It's always easier to do the activation in sweatpants.
Okay. Because we want you to set yourself up for success. And it sounds like right now, actually, based on what you just told me, we have kind of a plan for the next week, right? So you're going to wear tights, you're going to do your glute bridges, you're going to do whatever other warm-up activities you just said that I forgot because I'm not a great interviewer and I've just forgotten what you said. We're going to skate past that. But but the point is that like me as a helper is saying, wow, it sounds like you already know the things you need to do this week.
All right, so how do we go about, like, so if the person already knows what they need to do and they're in that preparation phase, now they just need to take action. How do we support people when they're in that action phase?
Like, that's a great question.
Because that one is where I've seen, maybe even, like, is there such a thing as trying to take too much action?
Absolutely.
Because I think that a lot of times people get to the preparation phase and they say, okay, I know I need to clean up my diet. I want to eat less sugar. I want to include more fruits and vegetables in my day. I want to hit my protein goals. I want to stay within my calorie range. I want to hit these specific macros. Okay. And then all of a sudden they have this huge task.
Right, right.
And people feel, I think, they trick themselves into thinking that that's going to be fine. But I've seen a lot of people put too much on their plate and fail and fall short. So do you have specific ways that you would recommend people think about that action step or identifying the low-hanging fruit, as it were?
Yes. I think that's a really great question, because if we have moved into the action phase, and that's kind of where, Grayson, you're at with this conversation. Like, we've just finished. You've identified your strengths. I've reflected that back to you, and we now have a plan for the next week. And so you've been the one to elicit exactly what you're going to do. I didn't suggest anything. Right, you came up with those 3 to 4 things that in this next week you're gonna do. So then at the very end of this conversation, I'm gonna ask you, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the least motivated and 10 being the absolute most motivated to make these changes this week, where are you on your motivation?
Probably like a 7.
A 7, okay. So part of also what you as a coach can do, or to be truly collaborative as an athlete, is record that number. And so I'm going to say, okay, so that's a good motivation. That's a good ruler. It's a motivational ruler of where you're at. And so instead of saying, well, why isn't it an 8? I'm actually going to say, that's awesome that it's so high that it's a 7. Why isn't it a 6? How come you're so motivated?
is I really want to be more flexible.
Right. Okay.
I want it to look. I don't want to be embarrassed with my back rounding at the bottom of the snatch.
Well, I know part
it brings
of
shame to our house.
Yeah, that goes back to a conversation that Grace and I were having about, like, he wants to be able to demonstrate movements to the athletes without having to warm up for 15 minutes. He wants to be able to just be like, okay, this is, I'm going to show you what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And then just basically perform that exercise.
Because that's something I really admire about what Mundo can do.
Right.
Is, you know, if somebody's having a problem, he can just pick up the bar and say, no, this is the position that I want you to be in. And when I do that, I have to say, ignore everything about what you're actually seeing and focus on what I'm talking about.
Right. Which is also a good motivation for you changing.
Yeah, yes. Because I think that a lot of it is, you know, I feel like that's a thing that'll help me as a coach,
mm-hmm.
is owning those positions mm-hmm. better. Because every time I do get better in a certain aspect of, you know, that specific problem that I have, I learn something new that helps other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a lot of the time, like, sometimes the best coaching strategies come from the struggles that you've had to endure as an athlete. And then translating those for other people, because sometimes the people that are the best athletes, they've never had to struggle with, like, oh, I've always had great flexibility.
Right.
I've always had this great sense of strength or this fearlessness.
Right.
But teaching that, being able to overcome some of those obstacles and those barriers allows you to be a better coach to other mm-hmm. people, because you can guide them through those same processes that you've been through yourself.
Yeah, and one of the things I love about you guys as coaches is that you all have had to diagnose and fix injuries. You all have had to read and research and really work on yourselves. But also sometimes that means that the writing reflex can be really strong
right.
in both of you, the advice yeah. giving, and that stuff comes in. Unfortunately, if somebody, again, is in that weird kind of emotional ambivalence space in contemplation or in preparation, we get excited about that change and we just, like, lay it on them. And then they're just like, no.
I'm guilty of that. I've done that before too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, that's definitely something.
I get worked up
like
about stuff sometimes. Yeah. Like, I'll get right. really into it and then realize it's like, I've just ranted at you for 10 minutes.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And again, we know that it comes from a place of being a helper.
Right, right.
We know that it comes from a place of wanting to lift other people up.
Right.
So at the end of that conversation, we figured out, okay, there's your where you're on the motivational ruler, you're at a 7, you say that's great. Even if you're at a 2. My answer is, great, why not a 1? Because that's why also we don't do 0. It's a 1
right,
to 10.
Right, yeah,
and so that way there's at least, it's a little MI trick. You only do the ruler of 1 to 10.
Okay.
And so, you know, this what we're talking about right now is kind of the bare bones of MI.
Sure.
People who do MI all the time are far better at it than me. And it's actually far more complex. But this is, again, we're just kind of like figuring out what are some concepts that you and your athletes can throw in the minute. And so after you've had that conversation, just a suggestion might be for both of you guys to write down what that athlete's going to do in the next week and where their motivation is at, and then meet again in the next week and avoid the writing reflex and just say, what was this week like for you?
Yeah.
What was tough for you? What were some successes? And let's revisit, okay, where are you at? And it's quite possible that their motivation may take a dip. We may need to retool. And again, that's at that action piece talking about, okay, let's evaluate those 3 things that you said that you were going to change this week. Because it's possible, Grayson, that you had listed maybe 8 or 9 things that you wanted to change.
Yeah.
And that's a piece of where my expertise or your expertise as a coach says, okay, here's how would you feel if we focused on these couple things? And a great way to ask to get them to identify it is say, what are your top 3? You've got 7 here, and that's great. You have so many things you can do
right.
this week, but what are your top 3? What are the ones that you value the most?
Right, and bringing up value again,
yes.
making sure that they understand that what they're attaching their action to has value for them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So this is something that I've struggled with on a personal level, because when I was in the military, you kind of get the mentality of just like, suck it up, get it done.
Right.
Motivation doesn't matter, just do it,
right.
have discipline. And so, not everybody thinks that way, and
yes.
not everybody has that same mentality or that way of going about things. So, like, I've had to transition from having that kind of mentality of where just like tell other people to get it done.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter if you're motivated or not. Just make sure the mission happens. Like, make
mm-hmm.
sure the mission's accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
But like transitioning from that type of military mindset to civilian life, where not everybody has the same motivations, not everybody's
right.
has the same like conditions of how they're going about trying to accomplish things. So like, this has been something that I've struggled with, like motivational interviewing and being open, having like open-ended conversations, mm-hmm. like getting people to buy into what I'm trying to help them do. Mm-hmm. That's been a struggle for me. So like, this is a huge topic that that I'm interested in getting better at. But like, this is, so far it's been fascinating. So let's move on to once you are taking action and then trying to maintain that action.
Yes.
So like, sometimes people will fall off. So like, let's talk about maybe one of the big things with athletes and sports nowadays is sleep hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's say you've developed a routine, you decided that yeah, sleep mm-hmm. was important, and we're trying to, you know, improve upon that habit, and you've been doing it for a while, and then all of a sudden you kind of fall off.
Right.
So how do you get people back onto the train of that, like get back to the action phase, mm-hmm. get back to doing the things that they need to and then maintaining mm-hmm. that?
And so there's that piece of maintenance where they're doing pretty well and sustaining it, and then there's the relapse. And we have to recognize that relapse, and I'm using that term generally not just to refer to any maladaptive behavior, like you said, is that I've fallen off the wagon.
Right.
I've fallen into those back poor habits.
Right.
Is that relapse is something we have to prepare for and talk about. Because if we say that it doesn't happen, that's just unrealistic.
Right, because it does happen.
It does happen.
Yeah.
And the issue also, I just wanted to kind of go back to a second about what you said about how there's this, you know, one mentality of just if you want it bad enough, you'll make it happen.
Right,
and
right.
adjusting that to allow for people for more ambiguity, because people don't live in vacuums.
Right. It's not a black and white world.
Right.
It's not.
And so maybe, you know, some of my other things that I highly value in this world are actually perhaps presenting barriers to some of my change in the gym. I got to figure out what those are.
Sure.
But as far as the maintenance and relapse, the way that you prepare for relapse is by talking about it with your athlete while they're in maintenance. So continually saying, wow, what is going really well? You know, and over this next week, do you feel like this is a sustainable change? And just kind of always talking about and addressing barriers and preparing for them. So, okay, you know, you've done, the wonderful thing is you've done really well the last 6 weeks, but you've told me before as an athlete that about the seventh or eighth week, somewhere into 2 months, it falls off.
Sure.
And we always want to end on the what's called sustained talk. So we always want to end on what are some of your strengths and what are the good things that you can keep doing to prepare for it.
Okay.
And then when relapse happens, we don't go, all right, how'd you fuck up?
Right. Yeah. And that happens too, because like, people will be doing good. And when you see them doing good, you have a tendency to kind of like back off and disengage a little bit, because they're like, oh, they're doing fine now.
Right.
Like they're okay. But that's not always the case. Like sometimes they are doing okay at the moment, but they're not necessarily going to be in a few weeks when they hit some barriers.
Right.
So whether like, that motivation or like that behavior kind of like changes because something else threw it off. But like, yeah, so like when that happens, preparing them for mm-hmm. barriers that might pop up mm-hmm. ahead of time, so they know like, oh, this is gonna happen, like,
yes.
but I just need to be aware of it. It's just like those road signs that are telling you that, oh, something on the way is gonna be messed up. There's a bump in the road, there's construction on the way, like just some indicators that this might not go as smoothly mm-hmm. as it is right now.
And if you look at those stages of change of, you know, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance and as relapse as a wheel, and that wheel is actually an upward spiral. So it's not a staircase, because we don't want to think about us falling down the stairs.
Right, right.
And yeah, when you a common thing in substance use that used to be, that's really, really unfortunate, is that relapse, you lose all the skills that you gained, which is crap. You actually don't lose anything. It's just we need to refocus and retool. So if I have a relapse where I haven't been smoking for a long time and then I start again, it's not, I need to go all the way back to the beginning and learn the very new stuff. No, it's, okay, so how can we refocus? And what do you think you can build on again this time? And also talking about relapse and preparing for it does not cause it. There is this whole thing that used to be that, oh, okay, so if we talk about falling into bad patterns again, it's going to unconsciously make people do that. And research has shown that it doesn't. And so that way, when somebody does fall off the wagon with their sleep or doesn't come into the gym for a week, we refer to that as a slip instead of a relapse.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had a...
That makes some sense, mm-hmm. yeah.
You had a slip. You weren't here for a week. I'm so glad you're back. What do you and then you engage in that talk of, okay, what can we do this week to improve? Versus, wow, you haven't been in the gym in a week. like, this was clearly a relapse, and then I'm just going to leave the gym and not come back for like 3 weeks.
Right, right.
So the relapses actually turn into slips and become much shorter, and people are more motivated to stay.
Well, that reminds me a little bit of like dating too, because like people think that when they break up, they lost all their skills.
Right.
But in reality, you have the skills still. You're just going to reuse them in a different way, and you're building on them in a different way. It's just like, you didn't lose everything that you learned while you were in that relationship. Now you're just not in a relationship. You just need to build skills with another person again.
Right.
So, and then so like, okay, so if Grayson's working on his mobility, he's doing great, things are looking up, he's in that maintenance phase, like mm-hmm. he's doing what he needs to, how do I prepare him for a barrier that might pop up? What might be some barriers that you run into as you work on your mobility, Grayson?
I think that the biggest barriers is not allocating enough time to do it. So, putting something off and then something outside of the gym interfering with the time that I get to lift.
Okay.
So if I, leave some paperwork and then all of a sudden I only have an hour to get through as much as I can, those are the times that I tend to skip things. And then I've noticed that for me particularly is once things start feeling really good, I stop doing the stuff that made it feel better in the first place.
So how can I help you maintain that behavior? So if the barriers are time constraints and things like that and feeling rushed, so we talked about that feeling of being rushed, and that's why sometimes you'll skip warm-ups, how can I help support you continuing to work on your mobility?
I think that, just maybe even just saying, what time are we training today?
Okay.
And making it, instead of an amorphous I'll start somewhere between 11:30 and right. 1. We're gonna be here warming up at 11:30, and then making that a plan.
Okay. Okay. Just that standardization, going back to standardizing the workout, having a set time to do it. This is our training block time.
I think that might be
okay.
the most
okay.
and
bang for buck.
Yes, okay. And as a coach, just to be like devil's advocate here, you may get some people, if you ask that question to, they don't know the answer yet.
Okay.
And so unfortunately and completely unintentionally, you've put them on the spot, and now they feel bad for not knowing. So for somebody who I have assessed, okay, they're pretty motivated, again, just continually asking them, what do you think you might need to do to set yourself up for success? What do you think you might need from others? And so that way they can say, you know what would be really helpful, coach, is if you did that. And that way I'm not putting the burden on that person to be like, what do you need me to do? Because a lot of times if we are distressed by a relapse or emotionally ambivalent about making a change, we actually don't know that.
Okay. So it's better to ask what they need in general from other people as opposed from me as an individual. Like, what do you need from me as the coach?
You know, and again, it's not a bad thing to ask that question because I think it so depends on the individual. And the best part is that Grayson is motivated and he's aware, and so he could answer that question.
Right.
But you may run into some people.
Wasn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, I don't know. Shit.
Which happens a lot.
Right.
I don't know. Like,
to help them generate, like, what? So Grayson, one of your resources that you mentioned before is that you've got a great partner who's super supportive, and you've got a co-coach who's great. What might you need from those people to succeed? And that way they can decide what it is. And then, okay, how are you going to communicate that to those people?
Okay.
And putting in place those kind of strengths.
So making sure that part of that maintenance discussion is, what's your support system?
Yes. What's your support system? Absolutely. And then, there's some other classic kind of MI questions, that again are open-ended or reflection. After a kind of a complex talk with somebody, a great way to engage is also a summary. So saying, reflecting back to that athlete, here are the things that we talked about today, here are the things you valued are important to you, and here are the things that in this next week you're gonna do.
Right.
And so, never be afraid to like take notes during those conversations or even set aside that time with an athlete. Because the cool thing is an MI conversation, even going through all of that, because it's very here and now oriented. We don't talk about what we did 3 years ago.
Right.
We're not talking about huge, crazy things. Can be like 16, 20 minutes long.
Okay.
I don't know why I said specifically 16, but I did.
16,
so like,
seems like a round number.
That's the bare minimum, guys.
Right?
So you have to time it.
We have to time it. So it doesn't even have to be a crazy long conversation.
Right.
So especially if you get athletes that are newer or a little nervous, maybe about having a conversation with you one-on-one or whatever it is, you can just say, hey, let's set a time you know, that you can come in and like 10 minutes earlier than you usually do, and let's chat about this. And that way you're just kind of having, again, that collaborative conversation, taking notes, they take some notes, and then you meet the next week or in 3 days or whatever interval you decide.
Right. Okay. What I really like about this stages of change model is the acknowledgement that slips are going to happen.
Yes.
And that's one thing that I've heard Mark Bell talk about a lot, and his he says it a lot, and it's basically you're only one meal away from being back on your diet.
Right.
So like if you eat yes. something and you're like, oh, that wasn't on my diet, it doesn't mean that your week is lost, because I think a lot of times, particularly with diet, is you'll, and it's irrational, but it happens, in that you have a piece of cake, mm-hmm. and you go, well, I've blown my diet today, so I'm going to eat a whole Domino's pizza and even more stuff, and you kind of, it snowballs, and then before you know it, you've been binging for a week.
Absolutely.
And acknowledging that one slip up is just one step away from being back on track, it kind of takes some of that pressure off. Like the idea of like, oh, I kind of skipped this thing today, so nothing, it's all out the window.
It's throwing the baby out.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Catastrophizing the situation is, I think, a pretty standard. So if you acknowledge that, no, you're going to have slip-ups, and it's fine. And that's, you know, I think...
And maybe even slip-ups are part of the process.
They are.
It's not just, like, you're not going to be able to maintain this perfect batting average.
That's
why people have, like, a 550 batting average, and it's really good, because if you can hit one out of two every two fastballs, like, that's pretty good. But like, if you thought about it in terms of like diet compliance, if you think about compliance, like, even the RP app doesn't want you to be 100% compliant.
That's
like, it wants you to take some meals into consideration for as cheat meals. So like, the idea that you'll be perfect 100% of the time is like
setting you up for failure.
Yeah, it is setting you up for failure, but you have to realize that failure is part of the process. Mm-hmm. You're gonna mess up, you're gonna make a mistake, or you're gonna have a slip. Let's not even call it a relapse. Mm-hmm. You're just gonna slip. You're gonna get off track, but you can get back on track really easily.
Yes.
So you can get back to where you were before.
And I think, I don't know, I think, you know, having you folks kind of start to integrate that language with your athletes, particularly what makes me think of the and I'm sure there's more types, but people that are really high performing, but when they have a bad meet, and they go, essentially what we're calling on a bender for a couple of weeks, of like, their diet goes to crap, and then they feel defeated, and then also their training goes to crap, and they're beating themselves up every day in their head. You know, I know that I have done that. I have one bad training week, and then I've just been like, well, screw it. Like, my motivation's gone, and I'm a terrible human being, and I'm fat and lazy. Let's just buy into this. And so, again, it's allowing for that change talk and that talk of preparing. So, okay, so you had a slip. Let's call it what it is. It was just a slip. But we can catch it. And part of it is, you guys know your athletes and know, okay, here's about when this person may fall off. You know, or like, Allie had a bad meet. You know, how can I help her not turn that into a bender of a relapse? But, you know, let's talk about it. And just in a way of, like, moving forward. And not in a way of, you know, what you did wrong. It's all got to be, how can we assist you moving forward?
Because like, the point isn't to dwell in the past, it's just to continue to get back on track and then move forward from there.
And acknowledging if there were some barriers there. So if a barrier for me, you know, maybe I value, maybe I'm a person who values spending time with my family, and I've been doing a real crap job with it lately. That may be conflicting with my value to spend a lot of time in the gym. And so 1 week, maybe I really tried to spend time with my family, but then it conflicted with spending time in the gym, and then I had a poor training week.
Right.
And again, we want to acknowledge that people don't live in vacuums, and they want to be able to distribute their time well. And so maybe it's just acknowledging, okay, so you did really well in one area, something slipped a little bit, how come, you know, engaging them and talk about how they can redistribute some of that stuff, you know, or acknowledging barriers of body dysmorphia or financial issues this month. Like, I needed to stay at work longer because my paycheck flowed, those kinds of things. That's all important, so people don't feel like it's a moral failure that they had the slip.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what's really interesting is that, you know, people do assign this weird amount of moral value to what you're eating or how often you're exercising. And it's I think, kind of misplaced, because inherently there's nothing, I mean, weightlifting is an amoral activity. Like, there's no,
right.
Like, you're not an objectively better person because you spent 15 hours a week in the gym.
Right.
So it's like any other hobby. It's, you're not a better person if you're a woodworker.
Right.
It's so, yeah, you know, like,
maybe, I don't know.
Well, but you could be. Cool. Woodworkers are pretty cool.
But, you know, so, like, I think that, you know, trying to take a step back of, you know, what you're trying to work on and improve isn't a reflection of, like, your worth as a person.
Right.
It's, you know, I don't think that, you know, people put too much stock in, and I think a lot of it comes down to what other people think of them. So I think a lot of times, like, barriers that people have are, you know, I want to do this, but what are these people going to think of me?
Mm.
Or how am I going to, you know, be perceived? And I think that, you know, we've talked about kind of body image stuff, particularly with women starting out, is, you know, having the conflict between the new body that you're building and what you've thought of as the aesthetic goal for a long period of time, and kind of assigning a virtue to looking a certain way or doing a certain thing, or, you know, because I think people don't like to be thought of as gym people sometimes, because, you know, a lot of times it's like, oh, you spend this much time in the gym, you must be a vain, vapid,
a meathead. Yeah,
you know?
Just consuming protein and, you know,
bending barbells.
Bending barbells.
Sure,
grunting, a lot of grunting.
Interaction where, you know, you meet somebody and you know, you're in reasonable shape or you're fairly muscular, and then the first thing that stranger talks to you about is, oh, I should work out a little bit more. I should do this, and, you know, and then they get kind of defensive just by your physical presence being there, or, you know, they start asking you weird questions of, oh, why do you spend so much time doing this? Why are you? And it's because it is something weird to spend all your time. I mean, everybody's got their weird interests.
They
and,
do.
Yeah.
Our weird interest happens to be, you know, strength training and developing snatch and clean and jerk specifically. But it's very hard to explain if you don't have the support system. So people outside of the sport do not understand why you care if you snatch more.
Right.
And I think that, so building up your support system within the people in the community, within your gym, where people actually do kind of understand where you're coming from. Because trying to explain it to your parents is just like, well, why are you doing this again?
Right. And I'm going to tie, just create a connection between what you're talking about right now and back to barriers, is that, as, you know, a mid 30 something female who's strong, but also not lean, I've never had that experience where somebody says, where somebody has looked at you, or this experience you were describing as an in shape male. I've never had that experience where someone has assumed things about me that I'm a meathead or something like that. And so part of what we also have to do is acknowledge that there's systemic barriers, and that there's individual barriers, and those things affect people's motivation and also affect how they view, you know, like how I should or shouldn't feel. So, you know, for instance, somebody who is a young 20-something white heteronormative individual who's male has a lot less barriers than anyone of a marginalized community. And so when we treat kind of people the same way and apply the same cookie cutter, if you want it, you know, enough, you'll make it happen kind of motivational space.
Which, or even part of the fitness industry.
Right. Or even an educational space.
Yeah.
That's completely invalidating their experiences and their barriers. And so although, you know, I can't necessarily speak to the personal experiences that other people have experienced, like, I'm not a person of color, nor would I ever dream to speak to that experience, I can acknowledge that part of what you're having, you know, that you've identified is rooted in this perception, whether it's about body or whether it's about accessing training.
Right.
You know, I talk a lot to other people in the queer community about how they don't feel comfortable training at certain gyms. And it's not that anybody is walking around necessarily saying homophobic statements, but it's like, for some reason, nor do I feel comfortable really good training there, and that's a barrier.
Yeah, it is a barrier.
And that was an interesting thing that, where are we at on time? Do we have time to cover one more little thing?
We got about 7 minutes. Let's cover this last topic, and then we'll call it a day.
So USAW sent out a survey to kind of those, you know, marginalized communities you were talking about, kind of asking about, how do you feel included in the sport? You know, do you feel like there are spaces for you? And you had raised a really good question of, because we do have a very diverse community here in our gym.
We do. It's one of the strengths of the gym.
And I agree that that's one of our strengths, and I love that people, you know, of any background feel really comfortable here. But it's not something I am intentionally doing. So what do you think are some of the things that we're doing right as a gym that can be a model for what others are doing, or things that, you know, you just need to consider if you're trying to make your gym be as an inclusive environment as possible? Because we've kind of, I mean, I'm going to say we've kind of accidentally fallen into the space where, you know, that's the environment that we created, but it's not something that I've intentionally done.
We didn't go about planning, oh, we want to be as inclusive as possible, mm-hmm. but we didn't say we're not discriminatory either. Mm-hmm. Like we don't say that. We just take people as they are. I think that maybe that's part of it, is that we just accept people as they are. Like, you don't have to be any specific thing to lift weights. You just have to come in and put in some work, and that's really all we ask.
Which is a good thing, but also sometimes that feeling of, you know, we accept people as they are, just kind of smacks of kind of the well-meaning liberal individual in this country, sure. that just says, I don't discriminate. I'm like, but yeah, but nor do you actively support.
Right, right.
So it was a really, I'm going to really try not to like rage against the patriarchy for a long time and just shut me down.
Yeah.
But like, part of my issue with that survey was that they asked me on that survey, how do I identify? And it gave me like 5 terms. And I was like, so there's not even an option for writing in, because none of those terms that how I identified appeared on that survey at all.
Okay.
And so I was like, I'm, as a white woman, I'm not accessing the survey for persons of color, but I did access the surveys for women, and I did access the survey for LGBTQ identified individuals. And I was like, geez, this is super restrictive. It's like,
right.
gay, straight, bi, transgender. And I was like, even within transgender, there's so many more terms, and that's also gender, and not, I was just like, this is part of the problem, y'all. So, but they did ask that question, is like, how can USAW, you know, effectively recruit and promote talent? And I think so much of it has to do with the individual affiliate, and part, I'm just not sure, like, I'm not a representative, you know, of that community, or would I make somebody else be a representative? But just starting to have these conversations, you know, we have this great space, we did inherit a lot of folks from another gym that was a diverse community, but part of it is that USAW needs to actively recruit talent. And they did ask that question, which was good on the survey,
right.
because they said, how can we actively recruit women to be higher level technical officials? And I was like, I will so do that. I would love to be a technical official.
Yeah.
And then they wrote on there, they said, did you know that there's specific scholarships that for women and for queer people to access this? And I clicked no. And then at the bottom I wrote, how the fuck was I supposed to know that? Because you've never offered that on the website. When I've gone to USAW or USA Masters,
yeah.
there's no link or information listed. My affiliate wouldn't know, because, you know, how would they know that if an athlete doesn't know that? And also, even on like their Pride Day, I clicked on their link and it just sent me to a website that said, talk to your individual affiliate. And I was like, not helpful, USAW. So
USAW is not doing a good job of disseminating information that pertains to those types of
infrastructure issues.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad they're asking those questions, because
right.
that's really important and it's a great first step. But you know, CrossFit has been fairly inclusive of the queer community, and they do a terrible job because they've got mostly white people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like not, and they also don't make a space for individuals who are trans identified, and neither does weightlifting particularly. So it might just be a good conversation to start having with, I would say, your individual athletes if they are comfortable with it. So the last thing I would want is for someone to come up to me and say, hey, you're queer. Like, I'd like you us to talk, right? Mundo's making quite a face. Like, what makes you feel comfortable? But, like, I don't know if it's creating a space just like this podcast to start to throw out some ideas, or
yeah.
acknowledging, gosh, we have a lot of talent, you know, or if it's putting out a feeler, say, hey, anyone who wants to talk about this topic,
yeah.
you know, anyone who identifies as however you identify, like, come and talk to us. We'd love to hear it.
Right.
Creating an official space for that, I think, is a good place to start.
I think just having an open dialogue about it, and just being able to discuss some of the issues that surround sports and like those communities is important, because they're becoming more and more prevalent in both sports and in society.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time we got to talk about it and mm-hmm. make sure that like we're on the same page and we're all heading in a good direction with and it.
Just to bring it full circle with motivational interviewing, if my coach is trying to figure out what one of my barriers is and I don't feel comfortable saying it's that, you know, say in this space, and this could be anywhere, I'm not using our gym as an example, but say I'm trying to lift heavy and I am the, you know, only queer woman in the gym. Or like I'm the only woman who is bigger and lifts heavy or whatever it is. Like those are barriers. But if I don't feel comfortable identifying those or sharing those, you guys can't help me tap into my own motivation.
Sure.
And then I feel like it's a moral failure. So we're trying to, again, just create that collaborative space of thinking of ideas and supporting people's motivation, and acknowledging barriers is such a big part of it.
All right, y'all. Well, that concludes the podcast. So if you have any questions, if you want to continue to any points of this conversation, you can DM us at Albuquerque Strength Academy on Instagram. And you can also email us at asaweightlifting@gmail.com. You can reach out to both Grayson and I individually. But like these are the conversations we need to have and to increase our athlete community from all sides of the world. So anybody else want to add anything? Or
well, Ali, thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you guys so much.
I know that you just finished squatting minutes before we started the podcast. So we appreciate you having your post-workout shake with us today.
Awesome. Thank you guys.
And we'll have to do it again sometime.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, until next time, y'all. Lift no regrets.